Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured. Today in the studio with me, I had Mark Cohen. Mark is solo partner at Unbundled VC, an early stage venture firm investing in startups without the need for a warm intro or a pitch deck. In today's episode, we talked about the collaborative as well as the competitive nature of venture. We talked about whether a pitch deck is a good enough filter when you're investing. We talked about the future of the world under the lens of AI and how Mark uses various frameworks to think about investing. Let's get straight into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am really excited to have with me in the studio Mark Cohen. Mark is a solo GP at Unbundled VC, investing in early stage startups without the need for a warm intro or indeed a pitch deck. Mark, wonderful to have you in the studio with me here today. Thank you for joining me.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
So for those of you who want to learn a little bit more about Mark's background and what he does, do check out the primer. But in the meantime, you chose to set out your stall as a solo VC. You didn't take outside capital. Indeed, this is your own money. You haven't actually structured it as a fund. But why decide to take the path of calling yourself a VC rather than an angel investor? What is it that drove kind of that thinking?
I think there's... You could call me a professional angel. I am doing this full-time, or you could call me a solo GP. There's an aspect of it which is actually really just about brand building and reputation building for me, where I want to build a good reputation, and I do want to be able to invest more capital over time. And I don't think it really matters what the structure that you're investing out of is, as long as you're kind of providing founders with a good service.
Yeah. And I mean, from your perspective, do you think at some stage you'll therefore kind of go out and raise additional funds, or are you quite happy kind of operating in the way that you are at the moment?
So they're both potential paths. I'm quite happy doing what I'm doing. I think I don't have a independent track record. It's probably the hardest time since the financial crisis for any emerging managers. So realistically, I think it's unlikely to be a good time for someone like me in my circumstances to be going out raising. Having said that, all the things that I would need to do to go on that path, I think are exactly the same things as I need to do just to invest really well, which is to sort of build out my process, how I invest, do all the things I need to do to build incredible deal flow and relationships among founders so that people actively want to come to me and to take my capital. So they're both paths that I could end up on.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting to me is, I guess, you know, talking to a lot of angels, a lot of angel investing tends to come down to a bit of gut feel, a bit of, you know, passion for the industry, knowledge about the market, knowledge about, you know, the business that's being built. Whereas I guess, you know, in all of the conversation I have with VCs, there's a bit of abstraction away from that, where you try and you may not have knowledge, but you try and build out a set of assumptions and thoughts that allow you to you know, get to a place where you're like, okay, I could see this business in 5, 10, 15 years being a breakout for these reasons. So maybe I guess, you know, the difference between being, I guess, a general angel versus a professional angel, or kind of a VC or however you want to frame it, is the knowledge or the ability to take a very much more, targeted and disciplined approach to investing, right? Because I think with angel, if you are just purely an angel investor, you know, you might come out of a really great month and just be like, right, I'm going to write a 5K, 10K check, whatever, into you know, the first founder that comes my way. Whereas I think if you put on that mantle of VC and think about, you know, the returns that you're looking for, you become much more disciplined in terms of what you invest in. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I mean, I have to be hyper-disciplined in what I'm doing in the same way as a, you know, more traditional firm would have to be. I know approximately how much money I want to put to work. I know what my ticket size is. So I know approximately what my cadence of investing should be. And so if I'm investing too fast. I know what I need to do to get that kind of back on track. I know I need to know ahead of time which of my existing businesses are going to be raising. So if any of them are superstars and I want to follow on, and we talked about this in the sort of prelim, that generally I won't follow on, but if they're, you know, rocket shipping, then I will. I need to know ahead of time when those things are happened so I can manage my allocation ahead of time. Also, I know what then happens is sometimes in order to have the right kind of cadence, there's two or three things that you quite like, and they can be wildly different types of investments. And you have to have a framework for making that decision. Now, if you're an angel, you might go, as you said, oh, I've got like 10K I want to put into a business. Oh, I'll give like five to two of them and not really think that hard about it because I quite like them. I will stick to that discipline and say, I'm only going to do one of them. Even though they're wildly different, I now need to have actually a framework for deciding which of those things I'm going to choose. So I've built a framework. I know exactly what that looks like, what I'm looking for in founders, in businesses, how I go about doing that. And then I'll force myself to choose. And by forcing myself to choose, the other thing that I do is I force myself to learn. Because nothing makes you learn faster than having to make a hard decision. And it really makes you think about what matters to you. What are those most important things? You might then take that back into your framework and go, well, that wasn't 100% consistent with what I thought my framework was. Doesn't mean you didn't make the right decision. It probably means you didn't have your framework done right. And actually, you need to update that. And you can then take that back into your process for next time.
Yeah, so it's a continuous feedback loop. And I think, look, this has come up on a couple of podcasts, but probably, you know, one that's worth actually doing a more detailed discussion on at some point. But, you know, what you essentially describe as portfolio construction, right? Which is underestimated, I think, by many people in terms of its importance. Obviously, most VCs will understand portfolio construction, but I think a lot of founders don't, right? And a lot of founders therefore get disappointed when they don't receive an investment or a check or follow on potentially as well, because the assumption is, well, you know, if I fit whatever the thesis is, then there should be a reason that, you know, then it makes sense that they should invest. But actually, if the fund, or if you have invested in, you know, something recently, and, you know, to your point, cadence doesn't make sense. If you're writing 10, 50K checks, let's say, per annum, and you've written three in the first month, then, you know, you run the risk of losing out down the track, right?
Exactly that, right? So you might go, I'm going to write, so for me, it might be five or six new things a year, and it will depend how many of those follow-ons are happening in a year. It might be more, it might be less. If you've then written three in the first quarter, you're like, well, I don't have much left. And so you really have to think about, you can do that if you think they're incredible, and actually you'd be really stupid not to, but then you've kind of not left yourself much room to maneuver for the rest of the year in terms of how you're allocating. The other point you touched on, where you go, well, everything seems to fit, is, you know, I do see hundreds of things a year. It's probably like close on 1% of the things that I see that I'm going to invest in. And that means there's going to be some things that look like they tick all the boxes that I'm going to say no to. And they might be pretty good investments. I have to pick the best ones, right? And I'm constantly doing all the things I can to improve the sort of quantity and quality of my deal flow. So I want that bar in a year's time, again, to be a lot higher than it is now. And that does mean you're going to be saying no to some people who are going, I don't understand why Mark's saying no, because there isn't really anything wrong with what they're doing. And I think that side of what VCs do is poorly understood. Doesn't necessarily mean there's anything wrong with you. We're just sat here trying to make quite hard decisions that we won't always get right. And actually, you can't spend, because of the volume, you just can't dig into most of them. You have to make like fast cuts to most things as well. And some of those things you made fast cuts to, if you dug a bit deeper, might have been really interesting, but you just have to make hard cuts to manage your time.
It's getting to know quickly, and of course, you know, I have I have experience of that myself. But the other thing that you know came out of what you were just saying, I think, is that it is not as if on January the 1st of every year 3,000 decks land on your plate and you sift through them. You're like, okay, these are the ones I'm going to do this year. It is a constant flow, and therefore you've got to balance out, well, if I invest in this today, and if in 6 months' time, you know, there is an amazing opportunity out there, I've got to balance that risk. Now, that doesn't mean that you should not invest in anything today, but to your point, you've got to make sure you are investing in absolutely the best of the best in the time period and in the cadence that you're looking for that fits within the framework, right? Because otherwise you run the risk of, again, you know, just overextending and missing out on future deals.
Totally. So to oversimplify, if you were, for example, doing four things a year, right? Mm. Approximately, that's one a quarter. And you would have to go, if you saw something in the first week of January that you really liked, you go, what's the likelihood this is the best thing I'm going to see this quarter, right? And if you think it is probably going to be, then do it. And that doesn't stop you doing another thing. You don't have to go, I'm definitely not going to do another thing this quarter. But that's the right mindset to take to it, rather than, oh, I quite like this. Really focuses the mind when you go in with that mindset of, this is kind of approximately the cadence with which I want to invest. So yeah, that's one thing I do. The other thing that I do is, if I've invested too quickly, I'll go, well, what are the last three or four things that I've invested in? What I'm going to do maybe for the next quarter, and go, I'll only invest in the things that I think are in the top half of those in terms of that category, and not ones that are in the bottom half. That's a little bit harsh, because if I'd seen it 3 months beforehand, it might have been a yes and it's a no now. But that works the other way around as well, right? That if you've invested a bit too slowly, you go, okay, well, if it's just close to the ones that I've invested in at that point, then now it's probably just to get myself back on track. So there's some little very simple tricks you can play to make mental tricks you can play to make sure that you're at approximately that right cadence. But you do have to 100% have that discipline. Otherwise, you'll just end up investing in too many things.
Yeah, or nothing at all, which is the other problem, right?
Yeah, it can be both ways.
Yeah, because I think the thing that always crosses my mind is, how do you know that this is the deal, right? So you can do as much diligence as you want, but as we all know, venture is a long-term game, right? Like, it's going to be 10 years before you actually figure out whether you made the right choice or not. So what, I mean, from your perspective, what are the challenges operating on your own versus, you know, being part of a bigger firm? Because I think you've had experience of both, right?
Yeah, so I was at, small VC beforehand. I set up on my own, and the challenge is, you know, my ticket sizes are relatively small for venture. Is anyone going to care? And so it was actually,
as a founder, I can say yes. Well, they will. Right?
That's very kind, but I still need to make sure that I get as good deal flow as I possibly can. And so I think that is, when it's just your own money, unless you're, you know, I've been very fortunate in my career to be able to have enough money that it's worth me doing this full time. But still, there's a lot of people out there with more money. And so I think that's the challenge when you go out yourself. There are people out there with bigger tickets. And it's kind of avoiding adverse selection, actually, I would say.
So not essentially taking the leftovers, right?
Yeah, you don't want to only have the deal flow that is because the bigger players weren't interested. If that's the situation you're in, you can still choose the best out of those things and be able to potentially spend a bit more time digging into those in a way that other people can't. But ideally, you want to be in the space of the best possible deal flow that you can. So I think that is a challenge, and that's one that I've been trying to do, and so far has been going pretty well.
Yeah, I think there are, I mean, I've seen stories before, heard firsthand or seen firsthand, you know, where a smaller fund is trying to get into a deal, they get cut out, they don't get an allocation, even if they were potentially the ones that sourced the deal actually in the first place, and they've taken it to someone who could potentially lead, and, you know, the lead decides that, you know, actually they want to take the whole round or whatever it might be. And I don't think there is necessarily this understanding again out there in the wider ecosystem about how this stuff works, that that VC is both a collaborative as well as a competitive space, right? So collaboration, because obviously you need people that can both lead and follow and who can fill rounds, etc., but competitive because everyone wants to be in the best deals, right?
Yeah. And
by their very nature, the best deals become, you know, there is the scarcity mentality. The best deals become harder and harder to find because the best deals also know where they can go and get funded quickly, because often, you know, these are deals that have the right traction. Whereas we were discussing before, the pedigree of the founders is such that they know if they go to an Accel or a Sequoia or whoever, they're going to get that, you know, 3, 5, 10 million check. Whereas, you know, are they likely to come to Unbundled? Are they likely to come to an emerging manager? Maybe less so. But that's not to say that at the end of the day, your capital and your network may be just as valuable, if not more valuable, depending on what it is that they're looking for, compared to one of the bigger players, right? So it's about walking that balance of, as I say, collaboration and competitiveness, right?
Yeah, and I've been very fortunate so far that I've been in 3 competitive deals, one of which is a commitment that hasn't closed yet, and I believe I'm going to be in as well. And I've been able to be in all those deals and not be scaled down or cut out of them. There will be one where I am. There's no doubt it will happen in the future. It's inevitable. But so far, I've been on the right side of that rather than on the wrong side of it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I just wanted to quickly touch upon, because this sparked my interest. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff written about how for angels, following on your money is not really the right thing to do, because angels tend to take sort of a wider breadth of bets, etc. Whereas within venture, often you will want to follow on your money because you want to ensure that you maintain, you know, a certain level of ownership, etc. Because again, coming back to portfolio construction and returns and so on. And you will only follow on in those deals which you absolutely believe are going to be stellar runaways. How do you think about that? Because again, those are kind of conflicting. As a VC, you want to be able to maintain ownership, but you know, as angels, maybe less so.
So I have a slightly non-standard view on ownership, which is I don't care about it.
Okay, interesting.
I do not care about ownership percentages. It, from a math sense, and I was a math guy originally, it literally makes zero sense.
Yeah, because it's cash on cash at the end of the day.
Yeah,
right?
It's about, have I invested the right amount and am I happy to invest at that valuation, right? That's actually what matters. And I know people talk about, I need to own this much in order that it could return the fund. That's the classic thing that people...
Well, that is the venture maths, right?
Right?
That is done by most.
But in practice, what that means is you write bigger tickets and you have fewer things that will do it. And in practice, there's a distribution of returns, and it's just a wild misunderstanding of how that works, because you've just got less chances to hit it. Actually, what you've got, if you write the smaller tickets but you write more of them, is, or the ticket size that you want in terms of check size but you write more of them, is you've got more chances that you'll hit. Maybe that one is less likely that it will, can't quite return the fund, or is less likely to return the fund, but actually your overall distribution of returns makes sense. It's a wild misunderstanding of the maths, in my opinion. So I don't care about ownership. I care about, actually, in terms of capital allocation, do I want to invest more money at this valuation in this business?
Does it make sense?
And that against the whole portfolio diversification thing. And so if you're going again and you're writing a bigger check second time round, then it has to be quite a bit better than it would be to just write new checks into other things. And for me, it's as simple as that.
Yeah. So you're looking at distribution of returns, essentially the power law kind of in true effect, right? Like, I mean, that's...
Totally. And you want to be, if you think that thing is the one that is going to kind of rocket ship, and then yes, the power law, you absolutely want to put more money into that business. Often what will happen with those deals when they look like that is that actually, if you hadn't written that first check, you wouldn't be able to get into that round,
yeah.
Because it's one where actually, if they are going really quickly and doing really well, they're going to be able to raise their money. They're going to be able to do it very easily and have a number of options. Hopefully they know you and they like you from the first ticket that you wrote, and you might go, you make it very easy for them and say, when you raise a round, I will invest this much. I'm there.
Pre-commitment,
no problems.
Done.
I've pre-committed.
Yeah.
I'm done. Make it easy for you. Go off, do it. And then they'll go, okay, maybe that's still a smaller check size than I would normally have taken for this round, but we know you. We like you. You've made it easy for us. We can just go get on with it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. And actually, like, at some stage, I think I need to spend a bit of time just going into the maths, because I think, again, power law and, you know, Pareto principle, all of this sort of stuff is known, but it's not particularly well understood as to how, you know, how the maths actually works. And I think that could be a very, very interesting. I would recommend you write that post, because you'll probably get it far more correct than I'm likely to. I used to be a bit of a maths guy, but probably a little less so these days. Now, I once posted, I was trying to think about this when I was framing this question. I can't remember if it was off the back of a conversation that you and I had had, or if someone I'd had it with someone else, and so therefore I may actually be running the risk of having stolen this from someone. But I did post this, that much I can say, and it was along the lines of great pitch decks get meetings, great founders get funded. So let's talk about that in the context of your process, right? Which at the beginning we said doesn't require a warm intro, doesn't even require a pitch deck, and as someone who's been through that process, which I found actually pretty. I found it a pretty easy process, but I like talking. So there is a reason for that. And I guess for the listeners, just to understand, you know, to clarify, I didn't receive funding, but, you know, we remain very, very good friends. Why did you set up your process like that? And if you could explain your process, how does it work? Why did you set it up like that? And what benefits do you think it provides to your overall kind of investment framework?
So I think you retweeted someone else's post, if I remember correctly,
that said
pitch decks get meetings and founders get funded.
Yeah.
And it's a truism. Very true. But actually, the reason someone's tweeted that is because those two things are quite different, right? It wouldn't be an interesting tweet if, like, actually the difference between the skill set for a pitch deck or the skill set for a founder were very similar. If they were, that would be a boring tweet.
Yeah.
It's only interesting because those two things are not entirely inconsistent, but still quite different.
It's a snappy enough line that people get it, but actually when you think about it for a second, well, yeah, to your point, like, you know, you can now design using AI a good looking enough pitch deck, but can you design a good looking enough founder, right?
But even without the AI, it's an interesting tweet only because those two things are so different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what that means is it's actually not a good filter, right? It's not the best filter that you can have. The reason pitch decks exist is because you do see a lot of things. You can't meet everybody. And therefore you go, I have to have a filter of some sort. And it is the de facto standard in the industry that pitch decks are the thing.
I just at a personal level, I find pitch decks massively frustrating.
So there is a 100% a skill set to go and produce good pitch decks. And when something's de facto standard, in practice what that means is, even if it's not quite right, it's not going to change because it is the thing that's largely frictionless. Once you've done it once, you can send it to everybody.
Yeah.
However, I have introduced some friction, right? And so what I've done is gone, I don't believe that's a good thing. I don't believe that's a good filter. I am looking to both understand something about the business, but as importantly, understand something about the founder. And I think that is the piece that's missing from a pitch deck. And so what I ask for is a short, no more than 3-minute video of why you should invest. And so then I get to hear something about the business, but most importantly, I get to hear the founder speaking and how they talk about the business. And you get a feel for the founder strength very, very quickly. What that means is now your filter is actually much more closely correlated with what you're looking for when you invest. And that's why I do things that way rather than use it. Now, it does introduce some friction. There may be some people who go, actually, I don't want to do that, and go through that process. And that is something that
And presumably potentially also a little bit of bias as well, right? Because
So I think the bias is towards people that actually have the skill to do a good video.
Yeah.
We can talk about other forms of bias if you like after, but the bias I'm looking for is towards people who are good at doing those things. And actually, one of the most important skills for a founder is sales.
Sales, yeah, yeah.
And that is quite closely correlated with the ability to actually knock out reasonably quickly a good video pitch. Or you can feel that skill, that kind of sales skill. Those sorts of people will find it much easier to speak into camera and to record something like that. I can see you look like you disagree.
No, I don't disagree. I was actually just trying to think about how long it took me to record that video. I think I gave it a good few tries. And I'm someone who typically doesn't script. I think I did somewhat script the pitch video that I did. And I mean, I got through it, I think, in half an hour ultimately or something. I think what was for me, from my perspective, I found it actually refreshing because yes, it wasn't a pitch. It wasn't a deck. And I think decks for me can be confounding because they either provide way too much information or not enough information. You can't make a decision on a deck. You can only make a decision to have a meeting on a deck, right? I think is the point. And therefore I kind of completely agree that actually having that video as a first filter is really valuable. I actually prefer these days a longer form kind of investment memo from a founder rather than a deck. I'm someone that likes to read and to listen. But what I find very confounding about decks, as an example, is they're often just too busy. So I can't actually synthesize the information particularly well. So I've actually found a tool, I can't remember what it's called now, which just extracts the text so I could just read through a text file of the information without the clutter of images and so on. But I guess the videos, what they do, to your point, so A, they tell you whether the founder is able to sell themselves, the business, and ultimately as a founder you're always selling, whether it's to an investor, to a client, to an employee, to, you know, whoever, to the tax man, right, trying to get a rebate, whatever. And therefore it is one of the most important skills, and often why I would say a lot of technical founders struggle, because they aren't necessarily great salespeople. And then the question, you know, the obvious then question becomes, okay, look, I really like your deck, your pitch from a technical perspective. I understand what you're building and what the market is, but do you have someone commercial in your team that can do that bit, right? How do people, so I think you're using a very specific software for that, which I think was probably developed probably more for recruitment, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's actually a business in my portfolio called Willow, and it's an asynchronous video interviewing tool. Yeah. And those guys are doing great. But I've repurposed it effectively for, because this is kind of an asynchronous interview, right? Mm. I've repurposed it for this. But yeah, exactly that. And the skills you talked about, yes, exactly those three things. You're going to need to be able to sell to raise investment. You need to be able to sell to actually sell the product. And typically, actually, yes, while it's helpful to someone have someone commercial on your team in the early days, realistically,
it's always got to be the founder.
It's going to be the founder, right? At the beginning, it's going to be founder-led sales. And then, as you say, the employee thing is hugely important, because you want to persuade people to come and work for you that, you know, maybe have got other, the best people are going to have choices, right? Again, that those people want to come and work for you for a subpar salary plus, you know, share options in a business that might not be there in 2 years' time, right? You want those great people to still want to come and work for you despite that. That in itself is a sales skill. So that's exactly the reasons, and you sort of said it perfectly, why those sales skills are so important.
And presumably, I mean, like, again, it is still a filter, right? So you will take the meeting potentially if you feel that, you know, the video has ticked the boxes that you want it to tick. That still doesn't mean you're getting an investment. And again, you know, having been through the process myself, I think what I really liked about it was I knew that when we had a subsequent meeting, it's because something from the video had sparked interest in me, not in a deck, not in something intangible. There was something, and actually as a founder, that's like a really fulfilling thing, because you know that you're connecting at some human level rather than at some abstract level. I guess for a lot of founders, you know, the other thing that is, you could never, well, you probably could actually track this, but it would be interesting to see how many people start and then stop or never submit, because one would then have to question, okay, are those founders, do they have the appetite, right? Because as a founder, you know, I had, I don't know, 150 meetings and still didn't get an investment, right? But, you know, the numbers are very clear. You have to take a lot of meetings to get even one investment, and then maybe some others follow. You know, if you aren't even capable, maybe is too strong a word, but if you're not even willing to submit a video, you know, which is actually pretty low friction, it's not huge, it's not massively friction. I mean, people are out there doing, you know, pitch performances at various events, which again, I have massively sort of negative views on, but anyway, that's a separate story. But if you know, if you're not even willing to do that, then actually, yeah, are you going to be able to stay the course, right? Even,
yeah, I think there is some friction. It is the people that are more likely to be good at it that are more likely to go and do it, because they go, yeah, I'll be fine at this. That I think the challenge is in larger investment rounds, right? Because we talked about this before, you do get the pre-seeds that can be like 2 million.
Seven figures, yeah.
You know, 1-2 million plus, whether they then go, is this a good use of my time, when I'm generally looking for larger tickets. So there is some risk there. But for me, it's such an important part of my process. So I have made an exception recently, which is if a VC that I like is already leading, basically a credible VC, you know, let's say a GPLP fund is leading, then actually I already know it's passed a certain filter level.
There's some diligence that's been done.
It doesn't mean I'm going to invest, but actually I know it's worth a call. So in those cases, and I'm going to introduce this more formally soon. So what happened was I had like three of these turn up in the space of about 24 hours, where I had intros from other VCs going, we're leading this round, there's room left, would you like to meet this person? And I basically just said yes. They don't need to do a video, because actually I've already got a filter, because I may not like this deal, but I know it's not going to be rubbish, right? And so actually, I'll just go see them straight away. And actually, one of those has led to my most recent commitment, hasn't closed yet. So it's all about actually, can you get an appropriate filter so you're then spending your time and managing your time on the right one? So there is another path for me where sometimes if it's a larger round, where I can actually reduce friction even more for those founders by going, if you come to me, I'm guaranteeing you a meeting, right, once you've got past that point. And again, reduce friction, hopefully encourage more high-quality deal flow.
Yeah, and it goes back to the point we made earlier about the collaborative versus competitive nature of VC. Right?
Totally. And so I'm not in that space, and I don't ever want to be in that space where I'm competing with those sort of, you know, top tier funds, because realistically, you know, even if I've got more capital behind me at some point in the future, who are they going to take money from, right? Let's say it's a A16Z or a Sequoia, right? And they go, do I want Mark to lead my round or do I want them? Of course, I'm going to get adversely selected. They're always going to say them, right? Maybe the odd exception. But in practice, if I'm like, okay, but I'll invest alongside those people, that's actually a less competitive space that you sit in. And so actually that's the way that I maximize my deal flow opportunities and the quality of them.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it makes a huge amount of sense. And, you know, again, I've had this conversation with others, right? Like, word gets around. So even if you were, as an example, to even go out and raise LP capital, right? Like LPs talk to other GPs, so they will know, you know, they will say, well, what do you think about Mark, right? And yep. If you've been constantly in a competitive space, obviously, then, you know, you're going to get less well talked up, let's say, to put it politely, than if you've been more collaborative and so on. So it's, again, striking that balance. Well, yes, no, Mark has brought us great deals, or it gets into great deals. And actually, you know, we like having him, you know, as part of the round when we do, you know, certain types of deals. So no, I think that makes a huge amount of sense. And again, look, it's a very, very small ecosystem, right? So figuring out kind of how to maneuver within that and make sure that you aren't, you know, that you aren't A, leaving cash on the table, but B, you know, aren't creating a bad name for yourself, I think is massively important. So just as we kind of round off, you founded Paradigm Gaming back in the early noughties, I think, which at the time was the best AI poker player in the world, and then went into the world of systematic trading, right? From those earlier days of AI to today, we've seen it finally, I would say, become pretty mainstream, obviously. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about OpenAI and ChatGPT on previous podcasts, but not in particularly any massive depth. But, you know, when you and I were talking about this podcast, you said, if AI really does change the world, how will it affect the way that you think about investing and ultimately what you invest in? So I'd love to get your thoughts on kind of where we're at in that whole cycle, and again, how it pertains to what you do.
So we're at a very interesting spot in the cycle where, you know, at least in the venture space, like anything with AI written on it is like
gold dust, yeah.
Super hot, which probably means it's not the right time to go do stuff. That doesn't mean I'm not open-minded about it, of course.
Well, there's a lot. There's probably a lot of noise, but there are some interesting things definitely being built.
Yeah, and actually there are some parts of AI where very little has changed, mm-hmm. right? Where actually you're building and the tools are the same. What's really changed is these large language models that we're seeing out of OpenAI and the Googles and the Metas and that are attempting to compete with, although no one's doing it well yet. So what's interesting is what's going to be built on top of those things. So you can use it now, but how you use it in 6 months or a year's time already is going to, things are moving very, very fast. So this is what I believe things will look like, but actually it's a very fast moving environment is what I would say. So you've got those large language models, which are kind of going to be the foundations of almost everything. Then you've got people that are building tools on top of those large language models. And then what you've got for most businesses is they'll go, I'll use the tools that have been built on top of things like OpenAI. And some of those tools are going to be incredible, right? And they are absolutely going to change the way that people work. But what they do, and the sort of software development space is a very interesting example of that, is people already are way more productive using, you know, it for looking for bugs, actually writing first drafts of code, all those kinds of things. And so we're heading down a path where actually I think software development will look quite different. I think that in 5 or 10 years' time, you may only need 10 or 20% of the software developers that you have.
Well, I think we're already seeing that.
Today,
that's
one thing. So what that actually means is you'll have a huge over, because there are so many people now, there's a shortage now, you'll move to oversupply and potentially huge oversupply in that space, which is obviously bad for a chunk of those people, but actually it's good for the world, because what it actually means is it's easier to build.
Yeah.
It's easier and faster and less expensive to build, and it may mean that you or I can build without needing some of those explicit software development skills. And it therefore makes it easier for and faster for entrepreneurs and small players to build up their business and to get to scale faster and more cheaply. So that, I think, will be very interesting in the venture space, is it kind of levels the playing field between those basically with resources and those without. So for me, for example, as a solo GP or full-time angel investor or whatever you want to call me, what I don't have compared to a large firm is a kind of bank of people that I can call on to go and do research for me, right? If I go do it, I have to go do it myself. Now, actually, I can go write something myself that goes to, you know, goes on GPT-4 and they've introduced their browsing tool that goes, actually, tell me about this business. Can you pull up any information about these founders? Can you find me the competitors in this space? And it's much easier for me to actually pull up and go do that research. And I'm even trying with my son to build an automated tool to go do that.
And using Auto GPT or Baby AGI or building it?
I think he's going to build it himself. We had a look at some of those things, but we're trying to build it ourselves. But I think, you know, probably in no more than 6 months' time, that tool will exist and be out there in the world anyway. But we're having, he's 15 years old, we're having fun trying to build that anyway.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. But it really is it helps level the playing field between the smaller players and the larger players. And I think that makes the world of venture and building business and entrepreneurship very interesting.
Well, you no longer have asymmetry of information, which actually is kind of what drives a lot of the large returns we see. But if everyone has the same information, does that drive everything kind of further down? Or equally, I think, and you know, you kind of made this point, ventures will need less capital to get going.
Absolutely. They'll need less capital to build, and it'll be easier to build more quickly and to compete with incumbents. And so that, I think, is hugely net positive for the world, because what we're actually saying is...
But potentially problematic for venture.
I don't think it's problematic for venture, actually. I think it makes it easier for new business. They need less to get going, but I think that's fine.
They still need to scale.
They still need to scale. They still need to build product. They still need teams, but they can actually dedicate those resources where they really need to go, right? I don't think it's a problem for venture per se. I think it's a huge net positive for the world and for anyone who's trying to build.
I think, so what's very interesting to me is, as you know, I ran out of money in the startup I was trying to build a couple of months ago. I actually am heading down to an undisclosed location tomorrow to meet with someone who I can't necessarily explicitly say who is, but a computer scientist that I've known for many years, and we're now thinking about bootstrapping, building this on the side. Actually, running out of money in that business was probably the best thing that could have happened, because now what we were essentially trying to build was a virtual CFO, as you know. Although actually what you saw was not, made the typical kind of founder's mistakes of building the wrong thing for the wrong person at the wrong time. But actually now what I have in my head that we want to build, A, has become massively easier to build, exactly as you said. B, can be done in a bootstrappy sort of way, so that we can actually get to a point where if we ever were to decide to raise capital down the track, hopefully we're in a place where we've proven out enough traction that can happen. And I think, you know, what I see happening, and actually this is the other point that I wanted to touch on with you, is, you know, we've talked about in the past about bundling versus unbundling. I actually think that what will happen now is a massive unbundling of services, because now, whether you're a startup or not, if you're an existing consultancy business, for example, you can start building microservices that otherwise you'd have been buying in, from larger platform players. But, you know, I don't know, argument say you have Salesforce, but Salesforce does everything for everyone, but nothing for anyone, if that makes sense, in the sense that all of these tools are always built in a way that is abstracted away enough that they are useful for the largest possible swathe of people. But the minute you have anything that is somewhat specific or personalized or kind of necessary for your particular business, they often fall short, right? Now, you can build that microservice yourself. You know, if you need that, I don't know, whatever, DCF calculator, or if you need that very specific plugin for your CRM or whatever it might be, you no longer have to kind of go out and spend a huge ton of cash to do that, which leads me to believe that a lot of those services are going to get unbundled.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to come back I'll come back to that point, but I'm going to come to the point you said about venture.
Mm.
And if you go back to that famous Marc Andreessen quote,
software is eating
the world.
Yeah.
What it meant when software could build all these things was actually businesses that were not viable to launch because they couldn't be built without software. They would have required much too much capital to get there, were now actually viable and justifiable to go put capital into. So there's a chunk of businesses that, yes, will need less money out of venture, right? And therefore it's like, ugh, you might go, ugh, where's all the money going to get put? But in practice, what it means is if it's easier to build is there's a whole load of businesses that you couldn't justify putting capital into before because they would have cost too much. Maybe there's some incredible product that could be built, but the cost of capital to get there didn't justify putting the money in.
Which we saw a lot of in terms of sort of biotech, those sort of fields as well, right? Where you have a large initial capital requirement, yeah.
And then what you've got here is actually it's opened up a whole load of those businesses. And that's what technology does, is as it evolves, all of a sudden the business that couldn't be built beforehand, that either was impossible or required too much capital for it to be a good use of capital, all of a sudden is economic and people can go build those businesses. So actually, it opens up this whole swathe of things that can be built that have a really good use and purpose in the world, which is obviously net good for the world. And those are things that people can allocate capital to justifiably, which they couldn't before. So, I mean, that's kind of how it works. You're kind of always shifting along. Hey, we can do some more interesting things now that we couldn't do before. I think back on the sort of bundling and unbundling piece, yes, it's much easier to go and build that individual thing, which maybe to do really well would have cost too much money to go do before, and people can go do that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what's very interesting, we're going to have on the podcast, I think later this month, Theo Priestley, who's a futurist. He's very active on Twitter, and you'll see him getting quite frustrated with a lot of the over-grandizing of kind of the potential for AI and certainly, you know, what that might mean in terms of jobs and so on. But I think there is a balance, right? So it sounds like you are an optimist as to where it could take us. And I would definitely fall into that camp. I do have, I wouldn't say concerns. I mean, I speak to my daughters, my nieces, my nephews about what the world's going to look like in the next 5-10 years. And I try and sway them away, as you have done for your own son, from looking at specific kind of disciplines, because they will get, you know, eaten up essentially, or become less valuable in a world of where AI is a bit ubiquitous. I think there are questions around things like, you know, well, okay, does that mean introduction of UBI, you know, universal basic income? Are there going to be large swathes of the population that don't have jobs? I actually think what happens is that people's creativity gets unleashed, and as people's creativity gets unleashed, there's more stuff to build, right? And it becomes a positive cycle. So, I'm looking forward to seeing kind of how all of this pans out over the next 3 or 5 years. But Mark, look, it's been absolutely amazing having you here in the studio with me today. I know, and I'm sure you know, that we could probably go on for a good few hours more, as is often the case. But for the time being, I just want to really thank you for joining me. And for our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn? You're on Twitter? Where's the best place for them to look?
I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter. I'm active on both. But yes, Unbundled VC or Mark Cohen on LinkedIn, and at UnbundledPC on Twitter.
Yeah, excellent. We'll throw those in the show notes. And thank you so much for joining me.